Hello, I'm Gabrielle Scawthorne and this is Back From Reality. When I was 17 years old, my dad smuggled me out of a school excursion so that I could line up for hours at my local Westfield to audition for the reality television show Fresh Meat, where I would be competing to be a presenter on Channel V, which sounds pretty legit. But when you're plucked from suburban obscurity and thrust into the public eye in a world of sex, drugs and rock and roll, and you're not even legal, shit goes down. What happened over the next few months shaped the rest of my life in ways that I'm still discovering today. In this series of podcasts, I will be speaking with a different guest each week from the world of reality television. These chats will cover the highs and lows of the reality TV experience.
They wanted good TV, but their idea of good TV was being able to corner me and make this reunion like a damning situation.
The pressure mounted to a point where I literally just broke.
How their lives have changed as a result.
I got in the car and I cried, and then I did 37 interviews in 14 days.
And what it's like to come back from reality. When my producer slash husband excitedly ran down the stairs and said to me, "Bitch, we've got the vixen." Firstly, I said, "Babes, don't call me bitch." But then secondly, I immediately started to binge rewatch season 10 of RuPaul's Drag Race. I read every article I could find and I called every boyfriend or girlfriend I had for some communal Drag Race knowledge because I did not want to balls this up. I mean, after all, I was interviewing the queen who famously introduced herself with, "I came here to fight." She came across as one feisty lady. But as I was now rewatching the series, 2 years later, post the recent events with the Black Lives Matter movement, and with a bit more anti-racism education under my belt, the series read very differently to me. I saw things I hadn't seen before, particularly when it came to the portrayal of my guest, the Vixen. I had an absolute ball getting filthy with the Vixen as she spilt tea all over me. I hope that you enjoy this golden shower of tea as much as I did.
Yeah, it was definitely a yellow brick road kind of thing. It's like you always, the second you start drag, especially I started drag in 2013, so the show was very prevalent already. And it was like, if you're going to start drag, the end goal is always going to be Drag Race. It's like one day you'll be good enough to audition, and then when you're auditioning, one day you'll be good enough to make it.
Well, so many queens talk about trying to get on the show for years. You know, how was that audition process for you?
So the time that I got on, I auditioned four times. First, you have to submit a video request. They have a list of things that they want to see in your audition tape. And so you film that and you send it in. And of course, you like fill out some questionnaires as well. And if you're very, 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 very lucky, you get a call back. That was great. The first call was very brief. It was just like, "Hi, this is World of Wonder. We are calling because of RuPaul's Drag Race. We want you to know that we are interested. Don't do anything. Make sure not to say anything online or anything. Just that you'll be expecting another call from us in a couple weeks." And so it's like you just have to sit with that and not blab on the internet. You have to keep your mouth shut and hold on until they call again. And then they do. And I would say probably the whole summer of 2017 auditioning, and it was just phone calls every other week, and they would ask me more questions. And then finally I got to the point where they was like, "Okay, we're doing well." And so they sent me to have a psych evaluation for the show. And then after the psych evaluation, a couple weeks later, they called again, and I was like, "Okay, what do I have to do now?" And they're like, no, we're calling to let you know that you actually made it on." So that was in the fall, about August of 2017, and I had a month to get ready for the show.
And in that month, you must just start preparing straight away. What does the show expect you to have prepared before filming?
Well, they have an outline of all the clothes you'll need, all the categories that you'll need to have ready, and all the things. And they have a list. Some things are for runway, some things are for mini challenges, so that you don't waste money or time on something that's not as serious. But sometimes it ends up being something that was meant for a mini challenge becomes a runway, and so it can be tricky. And then they have like a list of different references and things that you should know. If there's like a specific challenge coming up, they might, for instance, they told us to be aware of Cher. We had a Cher musical. They told us to watch the first season of Westworld because there was a Breastworld episode. And so it's just different things that you have to like go in knowing and kind of do your homework.
So do you have to, because you're also a professional queen at that point in time.
Yes.
Do you have to just cancel all of your engagements and kind of knuckle down to get all of that work done?
Yes. And it's the trickiest part because you need to make money. So it's like it's a balance of, you know, going to the gig and making the money so that you can wake up and spend it on something that you won't be able to do for a month. So, you know, like all of your regular bills and income, someone else has to figure that out because you have to give everything you have to this new thing.
You're shot. And does the show help you financially towards the outfit?
Oh, no.
Wow.
No, not at all.
Wow. I'm quite surprised by that. I guess because when I watch Drag Race, I see dollar signs. Like I see some very expensive garments and looks.
Yeah.
Does the show favor the financially privileged then in that respect?
Well, in that it's a competition and a competition about like glamour and what you have. Queens who had more to begin with will already have an advantage. You'd have to have a very bad personality to come with to enter into the show with, you know, very expensive looks and still not do well. It's not your clothes, it's you.
You can really take responsibility for losing here.
Yeah.
Did you feel the pressure there? That must add a certain amount of strain.
Absolutely. A lot of us who were on the show and coming from a worse off socioeconomic background, definitely felt that we were at a disadvantage. And then you spend more time overcompensating for the money that you don't have and like trying to appear as, you know, trying to appear equal.
Which is, there's so much pressure going into the show anyway, that kind of just adds to it.
And that's trying to appear equal, but in the competition, you really need to appear better.
Yeah, competition isn't exactly about, I just want to look like everyone else.
Yeah.
When I get a TV gig, I'm essentially kind of like, okay, like cool solid foods. Like we had a really great relationship, but I'm focusing on my relationship with the Liquid Diet right now. Did you feel pressure or did you put pressure on yourself to look a certain way going into the show?
No, with drag you can, you know, manipulate your body shape a bit. And I was thin to begin with, so I wasn't too concerned.
Not crash dieting then?
Yeah, no crash diet. Plus, you don't want to be in a state where your weight is changing because you need everything to fit. And so I did run into that. I think one of the gowns that I wore on the show, we were a couple weeks in and I had lost weight. And so it wasn't as cinched on my waist anymore because I was withering away on camera.
So there's actually this other pressure for you to eat more and to maintain.
Or you just have to adjust in the moment and be able to tighten and loosen belts where you can.
Gosh. And your boyfriend made your first look. Is that right? The Chicago dress. Did you have a lot of family support going into the show?
I did. The first thing is you can't tell anyone. At the beginning of the audition process, I just told my friends, I was like, if the day comes, we will have a code and that will be how you know. I won't ever say it straight to you. You won't be able to say that, like I said, that I got on Drag Race, but we will have a code and when you hear it, you'll know and just like batten down the hatches and give me everything you can. And so my code was, it's happening. And so after I found out, I had one of my friends meet me at the fabric store and I was buying everything in sight. And he's like, what is going on? And I just turned and I'm like, it's happening. And he's like, how do you know? And I'm like, would I be spending this much money if it wasn't happening?
And I mean, I take it if someone finds out, does that jeopardize your place on the show?
Exactly. Yes. You know, they want to prevent any spoilers or anything. They want everything to be a surprise, even who the cast is. So you have to at least make sure that if people find out, then you're not the reason people find out.
What are the 24 hours like before you start filming?
So you land and a production assistant meets you to help you with your luggage and they immediately take your cell phone. So I was in the car on the way to the hotel and they were like, okay, last call. And so I called my mom and said, you know, this is the call I told you about. You won't be hearing from me for a couple weeks. And hand over your phone to the production company. And you meet the producers at the hotel. They, welcome you and kind of get an idea of what you have planned for the first episode is with your looks and everything. And they make sure that you don't have any contraband in your suitcase.
What's contraband?
Well, anything. They look for anything that might have a Wi-Fi signal. You can't even have marijuana. So you definitely can't have any other drugs. So like for me, like I didn't have any specific prescriptions, but I had I take a caffeine pill every day in the morning. Instead of a cup of coffee, I just take like a 200 milligram caffeine pill. I was like, I don't want to not take these with me and not be able to operate the same because I'm like not on my regular regimen. So I had to have a conversation with them and let them know to expect that.
And I mean, you mentioned, you know, you kind of have this last call with your mom. Are you close?
Yes, very close. So I'm a mother's only child, so we lean on each other a lot. I guess especially just in the world that we live in now, in uncertain times, I didn't realize how calling or texting at least once a day is, you know, is very reassuring. And so not to be able to do that does, it makes you worry.
Well, yeah. And you're in this really kind of heightened emotional and mental state of this competition and to kind of be isolated from your loved ones that step further. Does that add to the tension of what's happening?
Yes. Because with everything that's happening, you're like, okay, and I need to make, like, I have to make sure that this is worth it because I don't know what I don't know what's going on at home. So me being away from home has to be worth it. And you don't want to go home with a bad story either. So.
And do you, have you met all of the other queens at that stage? Like, or is when you walk into the workshop, is that the very first time that you know who else is there?
Yeah, you don't know who's on the cast until you walk into the workroom. But the fun thing was before we all went into the workroom, they had us in separate cubicles, kind of in the studio. And so we're waiting and, you know, as production is setting it up, we're fully dressed and we're all in individual cubicles. And we have iPods because they give us little iPods to have the lip sync songs on. So that's pretty much all you have to listen to while you wait at any stage. And so at one point, someone in a different room started singing, and then a girl heard her and started singing along. And so there was a couple of us singing, even though we hadn't already met, which was fun. Because then we were like, once we all got together, we were like, okay, so who started off the sing along?
And who was that flat bitch?
And it was Vanjie, of course. It was Vanjie.
And so then you walk into the workroom and you say, I came here to fight. Did you write that?
It was kind of a suggestion from my friends. There's a show called Bad Girls Club on Oxygen. There's a scene where a girl is very nonchalantly saying, I'm just here to fight, I'm going to be honest. It had become a gif and people were using it online and people would just say like, oh, Vixen, this is so you, this is so you. And so the plan was to come in and very aloofly say, I'm just here to fight, I'm going to be honest. And it just did not come out that way at all.
Do you think that it was the clenched fists?
The bullhorns, the clenched fists, the fire engine red hair, everything was sending a different message. I mean, it didn't look like I was joking. I looked very serious about what I was saying.
So you didn't know who else you were competing with apart from your harmonizing. You've said that statement. How does the room take you in and how do you take the room in?
Well, so first I had to, because of just my height and the placement and the mark when you first come out, I had to say my line about four times just to get everything right. But that means that the girls watched me come walk into the room yelling four times, each time probably more aggressive than the last. And so when I finally got to turn around, you can kind of see that I like take a like a finally face, like, ugh, like that's over. And I could finally walk over to the girls and I'm like trying to go in with like a big smile and everybody's like, okay.
You said what you said.
You said what you said. And so then from that point, every little thing I said that was assertive was, you know, like, oh, there's the fighter. Oh, we see it now. And it's like, oh, okay.
And when you said that you had to kind of film it four times, were you encouraged to be more aggressive?
No, it was purely just my nerves. The first time I was worried about not being loud enough on the microphone, because what do I know about television? The first take is probably the one that they used because I was very loud because I didn't know how loud my voice would be in the room, you know, anything like that. And so I just like projected. And then the next couple of times, you know, you're trying a little bit different, but it's so weird and so awkward.
Yeah. I want to touch back on the multitasking of talent that is involved in Drag Race. It just boggles me when I watch it, the sheer skill and dedication that you have to be on that show, because A, your looks need to be immaculate, fully thought out, but then you have to sing, dance, lip sync, learning choreography. You're filming two challenges every week. You know, because if you're on Project Runway or something like that, it's like, yeah, you make a look.
Right.
I'm not downplaying that at all.
But it's very true. You make a look for the week. We make a look, and then there's no Project Runway hairstylist or salon to take them to. You.
That's you too. It's like if there were credits, it would just be like the vixen, the vixen, the vixen. You know, it's just, there's so much pressure. And so what is like a standard filming day of Drag Race like for you?
So you go in and in the morning you go ready for your boy interviews that they use on the side of the episodes. You go and each of us go into individual interview rooms with the producers and they ask us about the day before, you know, things that happened. And so we kind of give our reactions to things that happened the night or the day before, because there's only so many producers. So while you're waiting for your turn to go into the room to be interviewed, you can be working on what you might have to wear that day. If you're already aware of a challenge or if there's a dress that needs some extra rhinestones, it's how you kill time. And once that's all done, then we stand outside of the studio and come back in to pretend like it's the beginning of the workday and we start filming the next episode. And that's when we are given like a mini challenge, and then that mini challenge kind of decides who will have a little bit more of an advantage during the main challenge, and that can be any different kind of things. And then you go into the main challenge, or you get your assignment for the main challenge, and typically they let you start working on it if it's choreography or you know, like building something. They let you start working on it on camera for a while, and then after they cut, you may have 2 more hours to work on it, but by that time it's 4 in the morning. So they'll let you work till about 2 or 4 in the morning, depending on what it is. And then you have to go back to the hotel. If you need to, you can take something that you have to work on with you, but only one thing. And you can only take something if everybody takes something, because they are concerned about us complaining about fairness. Then you do that and you get to the hotel and you have either 4 hours to sleep. You might need to shave your body again completely from head to toe. You are definitely going to have to learn a lip sync song, and whatever project you're working on, you're going to have to make sure that you're ready. And so a lot of us budget the time at the hotel differently. Sometimes you need the sleep. Sometimes you might only get 2 hours of sleep and you spend the others working on whatever needs to be done the next week. And that alarm goes off, assistants start knocking, and you're back out the door.
Even listening to that, you need those caffeine pills, babe.
Yeah.
Did you just get to a point of exhaustion? Did you ever kind of think, I don't know if I can do this?
No, it's definitely me. I'm like a show party kid and have always been in like musicals, productions, and rehearsals. So it was very fun for me to, you know, I think our second episode we did our first like musical production, and it was like so fun to like, you know, be up and learning choreography and like working out blocking and all of these things. It felt very familiar for me, so I enjoyed that a lot. I won that episode. It was very, very fun.
I was going to ask, because you won both challenges in that episode.
Yes, and don't let them forget it.
I'll make sure that's in the intro as well, don't worry. Does your confidence have fluctuations as you're going along? Because I imagine after that you're like, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but it's tricky. It's a tricky game, because the better you're doing, the more the girls see you as a target or like as a threat. It's like, okay, I did well, but now I have to not be a sore winner, because you know everyone's going to be coming after me now that I have a win under my belt. So winning is good in the competition, but it's gonna create more tension for you in the workroom, which definitely happened.
So you're doing these ridiculously long days. You've got like 5 different kind of things that you're having to do at any given point in time. And on top of all of that, you kind of have to have these open heart surgery storylines that the producers are developing with you. That psychological picking, did it affect your ability to do what you came there to do?
I think what's important is even in the audition process, you don't divulge something that you won't be comfortable talking about on camera, because, you know, it is going to get raw and emotional. You're going to be sharing that in front of millions of people. For me personally, if there was a conversation about something that I didn't want to talk about, especially when there was still a lot of the girls, it was very easy to, you know, you just excuse yourself from that, or you don't chime in and you let it pass and those girls can have their moment. And if there was something that you did feel comfortable talking about, or in my case, typically passionate about, you know, then that's when I'll get my camera time.
And do you think that these storylines, some people push themselves to what they feel comfortable talking about to get the airtime?
Oh, absolutely. You do kind of learn, you know, there's only so many hours in the day. And when you get back to the hotel room and you think about, okay, the camera wasn't on me a lot today, maybe I need to pipe up. The producers will chime in every once in a while and be like, you all, like, don't be afraid to speak up. Like, you're here. You have to make use of your time here. You don't want to fade into the background, which was never an issue for me. So you do kind of feel inclined to, okay, this is my moment. If you hear something that connects with you, you're like, ah, this is my chance to be heard, and you just have to go for it.
And you kind of touched on your relationship with producers and their interaction with you. Did they ever pressure you to speak up or manipulate you in any kind of certain way? Is there a constant pressure that they add as well?
Oh, no. Getting me to speak up was a little too easy. Okay. I think they spent more time and energy trying to get me to redirect my opinions. And I was not aligned with the show's values at all. And so I was loud and disagreeing. And so there was a lot of effort put in to trying to get me to, you know, drink the Kool-Aid and, you know, like, see it their way in these situations. But in those instances, their way was always putting me at a disservice in the conversation, and I was not here for it.
And when you say drink the Kool-Aid, what's that Kool-Aid?
Most of it is, you know, just toxic beauty standards that we all kind of have to face in different ways. And so it's like, if someone was to say, like, you look so much more like happier, like brighter in like a blonde wig or something like that, you're like, okay, I really don't want to teach children across America that, like, can we not say that? Like, there was one outtake that ended up getting released anyway, where Monet referred to my afro as like a bush baby, and I was like, we cannot have that on television. Like, do not, like, that's not something you should say to another black person on television. And it still was released on the website, and it haunts me to this day. I had to correct someone for tagging me in it and, like, laughing a little too hard.
Because the other thing that I noted is that Rue said in the reunion special, mm-hmm, that the runway is like a truth serum, and things just kind of come out on the runway. I have to question, how organically does that actually occur? Because there are some incredible revelations, especially in your series, that happened on the runway.
Yeah, sometimes it does feel very random. Like, for instance, my sister Blair St. Clair had a very kind of spur of the moment confession on the runway that she had, like, dealt with molestation, and none of us saw it coming. None of us saw the conversation going into that direction. And so everyone kind of, like, was like, oh my God. And, like, I'm still waiting to be critiqued in, but now we have to deal with this. Now I am very invested in, like, finding whoever this person is. So it can be blindsiding, because I think for a lot of us, you feel like, if this is my last chance, then I have to say something or do something important, or, you know, like, you want to leave everything on the floor when you leave. And so, yeah, sometimes things can come out of nowhere.
And you had a few moments as well on the show. Notably, you had a moment of conflict with Aquaria, and it was a very useful conflict, because I think you used the opportunity to bring to light certain racial optics and the implications of her tears and how that would actually impact how you were seen on the show. And I was just wondering, had you noticed these racial dynamics on the show in previous seasons, or was it something that you were really just experiencing in the moment and during your filming?
It was very common, and it was something that I noticed that girls on previous seasons had dealt with. You know, just as a viewer, especially when looking at the Queens of Color, you would see them comment about death threats and getting hate and cyberbullying. My friend, Shea Coulee, was on the season before me, and so I was a lot closer to the fire and could see how she was being treated and the things that she had to endure. So going in, I was hyper aware of what I was up against.
Did you make a conscious decision before you went on the show, I really want to address that?
I knew that I wanted to go on the show being as authentic as possible, because I think in the season before me, you could tell when girls were being timid or, like, stifling themselves because they didn't want to appear a certain way on camera. So I went in wanting to, like, be as authentic as possible, and I wanted to leave knowing that I was myself and that I could stand by whatever I did, which I did, which I think I accomplished very very well. So you just kind of get this like intuition. It's like, okay, I can lean back and say nothing, or I can lean in and like really like speak my mind. And I'm just more inclined to lean in. And it took a second, and I had to really push myself to go past the uncomfortableness and just like, okay, I'm going to say it. Even in that argument with Aquaria, you can kind of see the buildup, and I like slap myself on the chest because I'm like, I have to say this.
Did you ever feel discouraged from the producers to be that candid and to talk about racial dynamics?
Yes. Once the conversation turned towards the racial dynamic, the next day when we went in to do our interviews about the day before, the questioning was more so, you don't really think that she would be using white tears in this situation, or you don't think that she's smart enough to be playing this? And it was like, no, I do. I absolutely feel like that. That's why I said it. I do stand by what I said. And like, but they were definitely trying to lead me away from that conversation.
Because, and please correct me if you don't feel that this is a fair statement, but sometimes watching the show, it looks like there's a real focus on sexual discrimination, but maybe not so necessarily on racial discrimination. Is that fair, do you think?
Yes, I would say that's fair. I think there's been some progress made in making the show, at least in its language, less offensive for trans people, but I don't think that they've fully grasped the weight of cultural appropriation and things like that that may upset people based on race. I don't think that they've come to respect those issues yet. I mean, to be fair, the show has been posting in support and about Black Lives Matter, but we have not had that kind of communication from RuPaul yet.
You mentioned before that there's a history with the show, with racial prejudice when it comes to the fans in particular. And you had mentioned that there are death threats for black queens. And I've noticed that there's instances as well of black queens not getting as many followers as white queens who haven't necessarily placed as well as them. Have you been on the receiving end of any of that public backlash?
I think I was on the receiving end of most of it for my season. The other black girls in season 10 had it easier because I was the target. And so it kind of took the heat off of them. And then I see when the girls from my season go back and do All-Stars, it's eye-opening for them because they don't have a target to hide behind. And it's like, oh, now I'm the angry black one. And it's like, yeah, it's not fun, is it? So yeah, I definitely experienced a lot of that just by being vocal and standing up to white queens in my season. It just brought on a lot of ignorant people with a lot of free time.
How do you deal with that?
You take it in stride. You know, I had to, you know, come to expect it and not let it affect me as much when it came, because I knew that it was coming. And if something sounded innocuous or too serious, I would report it to the authorities. Just keep moving and hope for the best.
You don't have to answer this. What classifies as serious?
So for instance, we had our drag convention, DragCon, was coming up. And when people were saying things more specifically, like, when I see you at DragCon, I'm going to throw acid on you. Or like, I can't wait to see you soon or something like that. Then I have to like, okay, consider like, okay, I'm going to be in a very public forum where everyone knows where I'll be. People will be coming from all over the world. So anything is possible. And so in that instance, we got in contact with the FBI and like had those messages like hunted down. And like, I never got the end result, but I am alive today.
Do you think that the show could do anything more to protect its black queens while they're on the show and then also off the show?
Yes, absolutely. I think first it's about, you know, not feeding into the racial biases that put us at a disadvantage in the world already, and that the audience is already watching with this implicit bias. You can't lean into that, and you do have to be aware of it, because if you acknowledge it, then you can help correct it. But if you ignore it, then you're just helping it fester. And so I think it's a responsibility of the show to present us in a way that doesn't lend to the angry black woman narrative and doesn't lend to Eurocentric ideals of beauty, to where Bob, like someone like Bob the drag queen, for instance, I remember one week she was on the runway in a black sheer rhinestone gown with her hair pulled back, but it was still an afro in the back. And then the next week, a judge said to her, I'm still waiting to see you do glamour. And it was like, what do you mean? I was literally just in a ball gown, but that didn't look glamorous to you because I had an afro on. And it's those types of microaggressive messages that like teach us what to value on the show. And when you're doing that on display for the gay community across the world, it can be very toxic.
I want to talk about you leaving the show. So you place seventh. You go out to Asia O'Hara. And I think in terms of elimination, that is truly like a peaceful death in bed, isn't it? That is the way to go out.
In consideration for how other episodes had gone for me, my elimination was very, very tame.
How did you take leaving the show? How did that hit you?
I was heartbroken. For so long, for years, it had been my dream to be on the show. And to get there, and not only, you know, it's one thing to like you go and you're doing well and you like feel okay. But for me, the experience was so tumultuous. And so what I say is like, you know, like I got my dream and then it turned into a nightmare. So in getting eliminated, it was reckoning with you got to where you wanted to be and nothing went as you planned for it to. And there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to wait for the world to witness.
You leave the show. What is that first day like, you know, when there's no cameras, there's no workroom? You know, when you go home, when everything kind of stops, what do you remember about that period?
So when I got home and, you know, saw my boyfriend and kind of was able to brief him as much as possible, and I didn't want to, like, give everything away to anybody, so I, you know, just let him know, like, the outcome and how it went and how I was feeling, and we went to a spa, a 24-hour spa, because it was like, okay, because I still couldn't be in public until the show was completely done filming, because they don't want all the girls to start appearing into the public in order, because that'll give away what happened. So we're not allowed to be seen publicly until we're all allowed to be seen publicly. So, you know, I spent 2 weeks in my house just ordering food and being in hiding and hoping that the delivery boy wasn't game.
And so then you do go back for the reunion special.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like you were really brought to task and held accountable for your behavior on the show. What was that like?
It was very peculiar, because as an Emmy-winning reality show on VH1, the show, you know, only benefits from whatever drama you bring. And it definitely felt like I was being punished for making good TV. And so it was very confusing. And even leading up to it, you know, the producers would say, like, how are you feeling? And I was like, you know, I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to, you know, like, we're wrapping this up. I'm happy to be crossing the finish line officially. And they were like, well, you know, we still want some good TV. And I was like, I know. But it was like, the season wouldn't have been as interesting without me. So on this last one, can I get a thank you? You know, like, you're going to get the Emmy. You know, like, we won the Emmy for our season. And when we won, they showed a clip of me as our nominee's clip. It was a clip of me. So, like, I think I've done my job here. But yeah, there was a lot of intent to put a nail in my coffin.
I have to say, watching it, that is what it kind of looks like. And I can completely understand that yes, they were kind of, in a way, goading you on to make this good television. So was there a bit of, like, on camera, they were reprimanding you for it, but off camera, they were like, great work?
And that's the thing. That would have at least been assuring in some way. But no, it was like, on camera, they're telling me that I shouldn't do these things. But the days leading up to it, they were saying that they, you know, wanted drama. They wanted good TV. But their idea of good TV was being able to, like, corner me and, like, make this reunion, like, a damning situation. And I didn't take the bait. And so they were upset that I didn't take the bait. They were really upset that I walked off. When you get to the studio that day, they have like a tent outside of the theater where it's all of their production plans, and you can see the different time slots blocked off, and you'd see like this hour block has like half intros, half Vanjie segment. And then my segment was like worth three blocks of time. So it was already obvious that they expected to get a lot out of me that day. And I think even with me walking off the show, my segment still takes up a big chunk of the episode.
That decision to leave the room, did that happen in the moment?
Yes, it did. But it was, I will say that I went in with it as a plan B. I knew that things could go left. I didn't know how or why things might go left, but I knew that, you know, it was going to be a very stressful day. And my assistant is a reality show buff, and so loves all the housewives and stuff like that, and watches all the reunions, and jokingly said, like, what if you walked off? And I was like, and like in the back of my mind, I started writing my speech, like, in case I needed to walk. So like when I walked off, I said, you know, I came here to thank my fans for all the wonderful people who support me, understand me, and believe in me. And now that I've done that, y'all can have a good night. And that was definitely rehearsed. I was ready for that moment. And I was glad that I had thought about what I would say if I needed to do that, because I think it was iconic.
And do you know what? It's making a bit more sense now why they spend so much time talking about your exit, because they had those three blocks to fill.
Yeah, they had to. So any explanation that I gave for my behavior couldn't be accepted because we still got 30 minutes on the clock. You
know? But in that fill, Ruinasia particularly, they start talking about your exit. And Asia had said we should have helped her more. We should have gone after her. Do you think that someone going after you and stopping you, would you have come back? Did you want someone to stop you?
No, absolutely not. The first thing I did when I got, because the studio was connected to our hotel, so when I walked off, I literally walked straight to my hotel room and up the elevator and into the room. And I got there and my boyfriend was there, and I told him, I said, don't say a word. Take this microphone off of me. And I took the microphone off and I put it in the hallway. And then I immediately got out of drag. I like covered my face in lotion and oil and I wiped it all off. And I wanted to be complete out of drag by the time a producer was able to find me, because I wanted to be very clear that this was not a stunt. I wasn't vying for attention. I am done. And I mean it. And so we packed up and I was going ahead to lunch, and then the producers cornered me.
That's so classy.
Well, thank you. It was very entertaining. Like the producer come in and talked to me and the conversation did not go well. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to lunch. I don't need this. I'm not even going to be around for the rest of the filming. Don't call me. Don't ask me to do anything. And so as I'm leaving the hotel and like, you know, me, my boyfriend and my assistant, there's like four producers like walking out of the building with me like, are you sure? Are you okay? I'm like, goodbye now. Like, yeah, I think they were very worried about like me posting something online in the heat of the moment. And I was trying to be as calm as possible and just make it very clear that, you know, like you continue on with what you have to do, but I am no longer a part of this. And one of the producers even threatened to take my hotel room away from me. And I was like, go right ahead. I have my assistants on another floor in a hotel room I have paid for. And I would be glad to get on Instagram and tell them how I've been kicked out of my room at my own reunion.
They were going to make you homeless? They were threatening to make you homeless?
There was an insinuation that, you know, like you didn't film the show, but you're here in this hotel room on a dime.
And had you filmed the grand finale by then?
Yes, we filmed the grand finale the day before we filmed the reunion. So we already went in knowing about what the most likely outcome was going to be.
Ah, television.
Yes.
Very crafty there, because I was like, oh, wow. And then you had to go back for the finale. No, good for you. You actually closed the door on that.
Yeah, if we had filmed the reunion before the finale, they would have been screwed, because then I wouldn't have been present. Yeah.
In the reunion, once you'd left, Asia and Rue have their chat. And then Rue seems to really double down to fill that third block, I presume. But Rue starts to say things like, I have learned how to deal with people. I have dealt with discrimination. I had to separate what I feel to keep my eye on the prize. Now, the sentiment in those statements, do you think that's a bit problematic?
Yes, because it's basically saying, you know, like, I think it's, as people of color, especially in entertainment, we feel that, like, there's only so many, you know, you want a seat at the table, you want to be welcome in the room, and you feel like you have to do certain things to get in the room. And then I think because of systematic, just the white supremacy that is in everything, especially in media, you feel like you have to placate and, you know, like make concessions and do whatever will stick and whatever will keep you in the room. And I think, you know, Rue creates this platform, but when you look at the 40 white producers that accept an award with her, those are the people that she's really answering to. You know, it doesn't matter that she's looking at a queen who looks just like her. She doesn't see it with empathy because she's looking through the eyes of 40 white men.
With Rue, do you have much of a relationship with her now? And would you ever be able to talk about, you know, the things that we were just talking about with her?
No, there's no communication with Rue off camera. When we walk into the workroom for the first time, our first time seeing her is when she walks into the workroom. You're pretty much never in the same room with Rue unless there's a camera on. If they have to pause for any reason, they might turn the camera off, but she doesn't talk while the camera's on. She won't interact with you without the camera being on.
Because you know, especially in the reunion when she says things like, you know, I chose her to bring her to my house. And it just seems like there's such a strong kind of bond between the two of you.
No, never had an off-camera conversation at all. While we were there to film the finale and the reunion, I ran into her at the elevator twice, but that was it.
And there was no acknowledgement?
No, it was very much like a nod and like, oh, you're one of those. And then kept moving.
Wow. Okay. A lot of the reality television stars that I talk to, they quite often express this uphill battle once they leave their reality television experience of having to build back their credibility professionally. But it seems like with Drag Race, that is the exact opposite. It's kind of like Drag Race actually legitimizes you as a drag queen. Has your career changed since being on the show?
Yes, definitely. And I think it, you know, no matter what you do on the show, it gives you the opportunity to do it at a higher level. So, you know, if you are a queen that is interested in making music, you can put that on display on the show and then you can parlay it into, you know, like record sales and stuff like that. If you are a type of person who is really into makeup and you want to start a palette or whatever, you now have a springboard to like launch a makeup product and it'll get 10 times as much attention as it would have. So in my case, you know, I was more a social justice warrior, but even still it did, because I put that on display for millions of people, it gave me the credibility to go back. And after I filmed Drag Race and after it aired, I was speaking at colleges. I spoke at Purdue and, you know, like all of these big colleges, and talked about racial bias in media.
So then how has your life changed? Your career has kind of gone to this next stratosphere, but personally, how has it affected you?
A lot of different personal effects. One of the biggest things is that, you know, me and my boyfriend split up. I think I'd say it became too apparent that this roller coaster that I was on was not, one, I wasn't enjoying it, and it wasn't fair to keep anybody else on this ride that was, you know, not pleasant. And I think him seeing me like have to deal with things that was so like outside of my dream and outside of what I wanted for myself, you know, put a strain on the both of us, because I couldn't be myself for him, because I had to be this new thing for so many people. And so that ended, you know, luckily I was able to, you know, get my own place, and like, but then that meant, you know, learning to live alone for the first time and things like that. So personally, there's a lot. And then, so then you're doing that and you're, now I'm living alone and I'm getting berated with messages every day, hate mail and death threats. While, and even after the show is done airing, you know, everywhere I go in my own community, I'm recognized now even more so than before. You know, I went to Mexico with my friends, and any gay bar, you know, like we're instantly pointed out. And so, which has its perks, you know, like there's good and bad to that. But my life is definitely forever changed. I don't think if I'm lucky, I'll never have to work a 9-to-5 again. I think that's very possible. I don't see myself ever having like a regular job again. I think I'll always be able to use this platform to sustain myself. And that's, you know, and that's after a pandemic and, you know, like racial uprising. I can still say that.
It seems to me that your relationship was kind of a direct casualty of the show. Would that be fair?
Yes.
Knowing that, and knowing how much public backlash you have to kind of withstand, would you do the show again?
Oh, absolutely not. No, for me, it's it comes down to, you can't expect the person that hurt you to heal you, you know? So like any wounds that I have from the show aren't going to be solved by experiencing it again.
Are they looking after you? Do you have a psychologist or a counselor that you can talk to? Is there aftercare for you?
They do offer aftercare. For me, at the time especially, I didn't want them to use me accepting their therapy as like a way to gaslight me later, you know what I mean? To be like, oh, she's hurting, she's in therapy. Something that we talked about is, after I left the reunion and Asia is defending me to Rue, the conversation kind of became like, one of our sisters is hurting and we aren't out there to help her. And I think fans kind of took that as if there was something going on that they weren't aware of, like mentally with me or something. And I really didn't like that, because there was nothing going on. I was being gaslighted in the room. That was the issue. It wasn't a deep underlying psychological thriller to unpack. And so I had to, you know, make it clear, like, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not going through anything. I'm telling the truth in a room full of people who aren't. And so it went from, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. Oh, you're hurting. You're hurting. You're not well. No, no, no. That's gaslighting.
And that concludes my chat with The Vixen. You can follow The Vixen on Instagram at The Vixen's World. Check out her drag concert experience, Black Girl Magic, celebrating black culture in all forms at Black Girl Magic Drag. And while you're at it, I strongly recommend checking out the merch on thevixensworld.com. I personally feel that the shirt that reads, "Go and have your cigarette, bitch, because it's done," is the ultimate stocking stuffer. Merry Christmas in July, bitch, and to all a good night. This podcast was produced by Hugo Chiarella for Unlikely Productions. The dulcet melody that you are listening to right now was crafted by Robert Tripolino. If you reckon this podcast is a bit of all right, please tell your mates, post about the podcast and leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find the show. Come on, get a girl out there. You can also follow me at Gjoska on Instagram. Yeah, I know, that's Gjoska. Not my best, not my worst. You could also follow me, Scorthorn Gab, on Twitter. It's my name, but backwards. Hey, we should do this again sometime.